This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, President Obama goes all out for his secret treaty to establish corporate law over much of the world economy. Can a civilian police review board put the cops in check in Newark, New Jersey? And the Black Is Back Coalition looks back on more than 6 years of Obama and says, "We told you so."
But first, New York City's police force continues to operate under the so-called broken windows philosophy of policing, in which Black, brown, and poor people are fined in jail for minor offenses. Robert Ganji is director of the Police Reform Organizing Project. His organization has issued a report that details the many ways that people are harmed by broken windows policing. Its title, "That's How They Got You."
It is 117 vignettes of the encounters that the abusive and sometimes traumatic and the racially discriminatory encounters that these specific New Yorkers have had with broken windows style policing. We picked these vignettes in each case because we saw them as emblematic of policy and practice. So the point of the report is not only to document the specific cases where the police behaved badly, where they engaged in an arrest or the issuing of summons that did harm to people and that was either unjust or so frivolous as to border on the surreal, but again, to have these cases be emblematic and representative but not aberrational. And the point of the report is to go beyond the statistics that many people who are concerned about these kind of issues have seen, that document on the basis of just numbers alone that the practices of the NYPD under broken windows are blatantly racist, but to then show the actual damage it does to human beings. And human beings who almost entirely are not engaged in criminal activity, but going about the daily business of their lives.
Yes, you seem to be showing that the broken windows philosophy actually winds up breaking people.
Yeah, instead of being an effective strategy against crime, it actually criminalizes people and gets them caught up in the criminal justice system. And one of the points of the report is to show what the collateral consequences of those arrests and those summonses are, so people can lose access to scholarships and to public housing. They could lose their job. They could lose the opportunity to get a new job. Parental custody can sometimes be threatened. Sometimes these encounters have resulted in serious physical harm being done to people for no good reason. There's an emotional trauma that some people experience in all too compelling ways. And then also we point out that at least some cops at least have serious misgivings about the practices that they are under pressure to engage in. So it also clearly makes the job of policing in New York City more dangerous and more difficult, and some cops have serious misgivings.
Yes, and it also makes lots of people, especially in Black communities, hate the police.
And it has a corrosive effect on people in the Black and Latino communities, because there's a deep, deep distrust and antagonism on the part of many, many people of color toward police officers. And that's a function of the day-to-day discriminatory practices and abusive practices that police officers engage in currently under the quota-driven broken window system of policing in New York. But unfortunately, we don't talk about this in the report, but anyone who looks at policing practices and takes a long view knows that officers with the NYPD and probably with police departments in large urban areas all across the country have engaged historically in discriminatory and abusive practices. And this goes back decades.
And under practices, you have listed some practices that sound more like crimes. You list sting operations by police that ensnare innocent people, and something called flacking, which is planting evidence on people to make the charge stick. Those are crimes.
Right. Well, also, and the police lie about the arrest and the summonses. So we know that cops, again, under pressure from the quota system and the broken windows policing philosophy, will engage in giving out bogus tickets and making false arrests. And so that's also, particularly if you then testify under oath, that's perjury. So, and some of the beatings that cops inflict are also criminal, because they're assaults on people who have often done nothing more than insist on their legal constitutional rights.
Here's one that I don't quite understand. Under practices, you list arresting people for petty violations that are not even crimes under the law and that would ordinarily draw a summons at worst.
Right. So what happens is, if someone in New York City gets a ticket or a summons for a very low-level infraction, an innocuous action like walking between two subway cars when the train is stopped, like putting your foot up on a subway seat at 2:30 in the morning when there's nobody else on the car, riding a bike on the sidewalk, carrying an open alcohol container in the street, but you're not being noisy or disruptive. The police in New York City give people tickets for that kind of activity on a regular basis. I mean, almost entirely, it's Black and Latino people who get those tickets. Those kind of activities have been virtually decriminalized in white communities. So if the person who gets that ticket does not show up on the assigned date to deal with the summons, a warrant goes out for that person's arrest. So the next time a police officer stops that person, for example, even if it's for a minor infraction like being in the park after dark, the police want to check on the person that they stop for being in the park after dark. And then if the person has an outstanding warrant, the cops will arrest that person, you know, put cuffs on that person and confine that person.
Many of the practices that you list don't seem or wouldn't seem to the average person to be part of the job description of a cop. Things like targeting low-income people of color on the subways and frivolous and bogus.
That's part of the point of the report, because these practices should not be the responsibility of police officers. There are other government agencies like the Department of Consumer Affairs or the Department of Health. Those government agencies should be responsible for responding to and addressing a lot of these circumstances. The fact that in New York City we have police officers engaged in these practices is wasteful of government resources, unnecessarily ends up in criminalizing people who are not engaged in criminal activity or anything approaching criminal activity. And the aim of the report is to expose these practices, because they go on every day right under everybody's noses. But they do not happen to, for the most part, people who live in prosperous communities, to middle-class white people or upper-middle-class white people. They happen almost entirely to vulnerable groups in the city, mostly low-income people of color. And our aim is to expose these practices and to, in effect, show how these practices are both a sham and they're also shameful. And the more the wider public is aware of them, the more likely there'll be political pressure on the people who run our government in the city to end these practices.
Your report seems to indicate that the broken windows philosophy actually encourages the worst instincts of police to humiliate and to harass and actually do harm to citizens.
That is unfortunately correct. The quota system and broken windows policing, in effect, creates an incentive for bad practice. One police officer, one of the few police officers that speak out publicly against the quota system, for example, said to me, if I break up a fight between two boys and send them home, I don't get any credit under the quota system. If I happen to help deliver a baby in emergency, I don't get any credit. But I'll get positive marks if I give out a seatbelt ticket or make a stop. And the reason that quote is important and illustrative is it turns on its head the idea of good policing that most people have. It's also important to point out and to emphasize the point that the police who engage in these kind of frivolous or discriminatory practices know that they will get credit for the arrest they've made, the ticket they've given out, even if the prosecutor declines to prosecute, or even if the court throws out the charges. So there's no pressure on them to make quality arrests.
Community policing is kind of like a blank slate. It seems that everybody thinks that they can write their own description on it. But many folks' examples of community policing actually seem to be essentially broken windows philosophy policing.
Yeah, we're very skeptical about the notions of community policing and what implementing community policing would really result in. We're concerned that it would be basically take the form of a kind of gentler, broken windows kind of policing, and not really get at the heart of the matter, which is that the politicians in power, namely in New York City, Mayor Bill de Blasio, have to direct the police department to end broken windows policing and to abolish the quota system and to focus on what most people think police departments should focus on, and that is investigating and solving serious crimes and be focused on apprehending people who are really a danger to the community, not making criminals out of people who live in those communities who are not engaged in dangerous or predatory behavior.
And Mayor de Blasio has not forcefully instructed the police that they will not use a quota system. I thought he ran on a campaign that promised that.
He did. He ran on a campaign that promised sweeping NYPD reforms, and he has not followed through on the promise. There has been a decline in the use of stop and frisk, and that's positive as far as it goes, but the NYPD is still engaged in quota-driven broken windows policing, still engaged in blatantly racially discriminatory policing, and he has not taken anywhere near sufficient steps to stop those tactics.
That was Robert Ganji of the Police Reform Organizing Project in New York City.
The Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations is gearing up for its annual national conference in August, marking 6 years since the coalition took a stand against the policies of the then brand new Obama administration. Back in 2009, the coalition opposed the notion that simply putting black faces in high places would resolve the problems of police state repression and black poverty and powerlessness. We spoke with Omali Yeshitela, chairman of Black is Back.
In order to build the coalition in the first place, we had to have confidence that the future belonged to the people and not to imperialism. You remember we had to climb across all kinds of opposition going forward with the creation of a coalition, our first action, because so many people who we had considered revolutionaries and nationalists and communists, etc., were in bed with Barack Hussein Obama, and through that, in bed with U.S. imperialism. And it was only because those of us who knew that this was a phenomenon of imperialism attempting to hold on to its authority and power, and those of us who knew that the future truly belongs to the people and is not something that could be held in U.S. custody despite how the complexion of the person that was U.S. imperialist representative. So we moved forward with that, confident that history would prove it out, and history is proving it out, and we talk about it having been a hell of a year since our last conference, and that's absolutely right. And everything that we had based the founding on the coalition on is proving itself to be true.
Back in November in 2009, the Black is Back Coalition held its first rally and march on the White House. It seemed, I'm sure, to lots of black folks to be a strange phenomenon since the first black president had just assumed office and his support was thought to be near unanimous in the black community. And yet now we see a whole movement of folks who are objectively and many quite consciously in opposition to the administration, to his party, and to his policies.
And that's absolutely true. And while it's not true that all of the people who came together to create the Black is Back Coalition recognized the ultimate problem with capitalism as a social system. Some of us did. And while it's true that all of them did not know that imperialism in a crisis had to solve the problem regardless of who was the public spokesperson for imperialism, some of us did, and certainly those of us who played the critical role in pushing this coalition forward understood that. And as I said, it was just a matter of time. We didn't claim to be fortune tellers or anything like that, but we knew the nature of the social system that we were confronted with, that we were dealing with, and we know that the system wouldn't do us any favor by handing us some great guy who was going to represent the interests of Africans or the oppressed peoples of the world. Of that, we were absolutely confident. And so we were able to look beyond the obvious manifestation of a wonderful post-racial situation that was being offered up to us and to the people. And I think that what was really critical about this, and something that perhaps we need to talk about to some extent at our conference in August, is that there's something wrong that there were so many people who call themselves leaders, groups, organizations, personalities, who were dead wrong on this, who held up Obama for the people, who raised no criticism for the people. And I loathe to think just how absolute this thing would have been for Obama and for imperialism had not the Black Is Back Coalition been on the scene up to now.
And the Black Is Back Coalition has taken note over these years about who those forces were, how they behaved, and how they're pretending to have behaved now.
Indeed. And Ren, you were one of the key people doing that. I mean, you debated virtually every one of those who had the courage to come out and publicly state support for imperialism through Obama. And subsequently, over the last several months, as you just suggested, the position that people had at the moment, they've been morphing, and we're getting a certain kind of historical revisionism coming along that they really didn't support him all the way. They just kind of supported him, et cetera, from some of them. But there are even some diehards who, up to now, who are claiming that Obama was the best thing to happen to African people since white bread.
And now it's gone far beyond Obama. 3 years ago, when Trayvon Martin was killed, we saw friction between Black folks and an Obama Justice Department that was being challenged to indict his killer, George Zimmerman, something that never happened. But now, in the last year, with the rise of the movement that people call Black Lives Matter, we see masses of folks going up against fellow Democrats, fellow Black Democrats in cities across the country who are, in fact, upholding the police state in their localities.
And that is true. And I think this continues to be one of the most important things that has happened to our movement. As you know, more than 40 years ago, when our movement was physically, violently, viciously crushed, and many of the people who were involved in the movement saw the struggle as one of having Black people in these positions of apparent power in the government and things like that. And what's happened subsequently is that there are perhaps 12, 13, or 14,000 African elected officials in this country, and four times as many who've been appointed to different positions, etc. And the thing has worn off. And what is happening is that Obama, of course, was what we like to refer to as neocolonialism on steroids. He was white power in blackface, and it tricked a lot of people for the moment. But right now, when you look at a city like Baltimore, where a majority African mayor, who is the one who joined Obama in calling the people who rose up and after Freddie Gray was murdered and called them thugs and criminals. We see Philadelphia and all of these other places where you have all these Africans with apparent political power. You have African cops and things, and it's destroyed the argument that was put forth by the situation in Ferguson, that the problem that we were having, there were too few African people who were on the city council. There were too few African who were a part of the police department. And the masses of people are having to sum this up by their own experiences, by what they see in the world. And increasingly, I think it's becoming more difficult to use these stooges effectively against our people and against the struggle for freedom, justice, and reparations for African people and for the oppressed people around the world.
In fact, it seems that we've come to a juncture where Black folks in the street have to examine the Black political posture of the last 40 years or so.
I think that's absolutely true. But I also think it's really important for the coalition to be involved here, because in addition to what people might get on their own in terms of their immediate confrontation with the police or their immediate confrontation with some foul local government entity, I think the coalition has been very helpful in defining Obama and what that means. I think the coalition has been very helpful in helping people to grapple with more than just the superficial evidence of police violence and things like that. I think the coalition has contributed to introducing to others, even within what might be broadly and loosely defined as a black liberation movement, the international questions, not as some abstract phenomenon, but the real implications that they have for us in our lives as people. I was just in Russia, and it's really interesting because Margaret Kimberly, part of Black Agenda Report, and the Black is Back Coalition had preceded me in Moscow. And I was looking through one of their newspapers, and I saw the picture of Margaret Kimberly from Black is Back Coalition. And that's how the cut line read on the picture. And I just think the work that we've been doing in various places to help African people understand that these questions of what's going on around the world, the ongoing violence perpetrated against people everywhere, the unending wars, that these are not just abstract things that are happening way out there, nor are they, as what many of the liberals think, simply a diversion of money that would be going to black schools and black health care, something to that effect, because our experience has been, whether they're at war or at peace, we don't get any black education, we don't get any black health care or housing or jobs or anything like that. I think the coalition has opened up this door for many Africans who coming into political life, and some organizations that have been into political life, but from a relatively narrow perspective. I think the coalition has opened the door to the world for them and has deepened their understanding of the relationship of what's happening around the world to what's happening to us as a people right here in this country.
The August conference coincides with the beginning of the presidential political season. I remember quite clearly that the 2008 political season was the first one in which the established national black organizations made not one demand of the Democratic presidential candidate, and they didn't make a demand in 2012. Doesn't look like they're going to have any demands this time around either, does it?
It doesn't look like it, especially when you see that the brand of politics, especially in the Democratic Party, where most of the African people at this point headquartered, that what we have is simply a continuation of the Clinton regime that has made itself manifest through Obama, and now Hillary is again about to, I guess, become the third black president. It's going to be something. And, of course, what we know we're looking at is that there's so many people who have created their careers on the success of Democratic Party candidates who plays this role to the hilt. And there are others, some of them who have jumped ship, I'm happy to say, who try and take some kind of reasonable stance, especially against the Obama regime. But when people's brains are locked into an assumption that we have no alternative as black people other than to support a Democratic or a Republican Party candidate representative, each of which, of course, is a representative of imperial white power. And, of course, that's not to say that there can't be some strategic basis for making a collective move as a people to enhance our position in the struggle for power, but there's none of them that can even make that kind of claim. So now you have a situation where it's deja vu all over again, with Hillary Clinton obviously being the one that we got to vote for, because if we don't vote for her, we're going to get a nasty Republican.
One of the lessons that the Black is Back Coalition seemed to be trying to bring back into people's consciousness is that politics does not consist solely or even mostly of electoral politics.
Ain't it the truth? I mean, how many of the Negro politicians have you seen that's made any impact at all on this incredible struggle, a movement that's afoot today around the question of police violence and police murder. Where are the Negro politicians? And the fact of the matter is, we are dealing with these issues and questions much more effectively, much more sharply than we ever did when they were being spoken to by black elected officials or by their henchmen like the Sharptons and the Jacksons and the rest of them.
And in fact, we do know where lots of them were. 4 out of 5 of the members of the Congressional Black Caucus voted to continue Pentagon transfers of weapons and tanks and other military gear to local police departments. And that was less than a year ago.
And, you know, Comrade, one of the things that's really important about this that I hope that we continue to expose and talk about more and more and more, because they call this surplus weapons from the Pentagon that they've been given to these police departments, local police organizations. But you can't call it surplus if you've been doing it since the early 1970s. In fact, what they have is been disguising the reality that the local police organizations throughout this country are merely extensions of the Pentagon, of U.S. military power that's been diverted for the purpose of suppressing and maintaining the colonial domination of African people and so-called Latinos, particularly in this country. And I think we have to keep talking about that, because even now, when Obama makes his statements that he's not going to let them use as many of the heavy weaponry as they've been using in the past, it really begs the question of why the hell, and in fact, I think it's an infraction on the U.S. Constitution for the military to be used as police in a domestic situation, and yet that's exactly what's happening under the name of this program that's giving what they call surplus weapons to the police departments around this country. And some tiny police organization like Ferguson, like St. Petersburg, Florida, which is not exactly tiny, but even smaller police organizations are getting these weapons, getting these trainings, and they are being trained by the feds for the purpose of maintaining the colonial domination of Africans and other oppressed people inside this country.
And the Black is Back Coalition never lets people forget that AFRICOM has extended its tentacles throughout the continent almost solely under the watch of President Obama, whose term is coterminous with AFRICOM.
Indeed. And we won't let them forget that the same Obama who went to Chicago and did his Sister Soldier bit on Father's Day by making an attack on black fathers on Father's Day. This is the same Obama that also went to Ghana, the base for Kwame Nkrumah, who led the movement to try to unify and free Africa and made the very extraordinary statement in Africa, in West Africa, that Africans can no longer blame the white man for our oppression, can't blame colonialism for our condition, but we got to blame so-called corrupt leaders and things like that. So he's been an extraordinary and to some extent effective spokesperson for imperialism, but I think that we're pulling the covers off of him and more people are able to see exactly what he represents. And on August 22nd and 23rd at our annual national conference, I think we'll even be able to consolidate that much more.
Omali Yeshitela, speaking from St. Petersburg, Florida.
The People's Organization for Progress, or POP, out of Newark, New Jersey, is a member of the Black is Back Coalition. POP has organized a million people's march against police brutality, racial injustice, and economic inequality set for July 25th. Chairman Larry Ham says the march has been endorsed by a host of organizations and individuals, including Dr. Cornel West and the mayor of Newark, New Jersey, Raz Baraka. Larry Ham and the People's Organization for Progress have been in the streets for more than 3 decades.
I think that this is going to be a benchmark event in the history of the People's Organization for Progress. As you said, our organization actually is about 33 years old now, and in fact, it was born around police brutality and other issues in our community, and we've had a number of very notable campaigns against police brutality, including the Earl Faison case, where for the first time in the history of New Jersey, 5 police officers went to jail in connection with a homicide that was identified as a police brutality case. So, yes, I think that if this march is successful, if it's large, if people come from all around the country, And if it's strong in terms of the demand and perspective that is given that day by the various people that are going to be speaking, I think it will be a benchmark event in the history of the People's Organization for Progress.
Maybe the case is that the rest of Black America is catching up with POP in Newark, New Jersey, in terms of putting police brutality and the very presence of the police at the top of the priority.
Well, I would not be so presumptuous as to say the rest of the country is catching up with us. I mean, the development of the resistance movement around the country is uneven. POP may be, in fact, ahead of some other places, but, being honest, there are some other folks that might be ahead of us. So we're striving to be a good example, but we're also striving to be a better example. And I think what's going to happen when people come from other parts of the country for this march on the 25th of July, I think it's going to have like a cross-pollinating impact. I think that we're going to learn from some of the other people who are coming, and maybe they're going to be inspired by what they see in Newark, New Jersey, and it'll help them to continue to push forward when they return to their respective areas. Because these police brutality stories, these are some tough fights. I mean, in many different ways, in some ways that are obvious and some ways that are not so obvious. The obvious ways have to do with the criminal justice system or the criminal injustice system, as some people might put it, and the failure of prosecutors to indict police that murder and kill and torture and abuse Black people and violate their constitutional rights. And on the other hand, there's also, to be truthful, and this is not discussed often, but there are also attitudes and perspectives in the community that militate against the struggle against police brutality. There is, among certain sections of the masses of people, a kind of deference toward the police. There's a whole problem of violence in our community. Now, I'm talking about civilian violence. I'm talking about street crime. I'm talking about the fact that the number of cases of young Black men killing other young Black men far exceeds the number of cases where white police are killing Black men. And this also causes a kind of conservatism among people who should otherwise be in the struggle against police brutality. And there are some people, I don't know why it is, it's very difficult for them to think about both problems at the same time. For instance, the People's Organization for Progress, we have and have had within our organization for 15 years now, maybe even more than 15 years, we've had an anti-violence committee within the People's Organization for Progress to have activities around trying to stem the tide of violence among our people in the community. But at the same time, we have always engaged against the struggle of police brutality. And it's kind of a leap, for some people to be able to fight on both fronts at the same time. I think I've related to you once before about an incident maybe more than a dozen years ago where we were marching in the African American Heritage Parade in Newark, New Jersey. And, they put all the grassroots organizations in the back of the parade, and we were in the last section with a number of other grassroots organizations, and some of those happened to be groups that had been working on the problem of violence in our community. In fact, one of them was the Mothers, MomSad, Mothers of Murdered Sons and Daughters. And it's a very good group, but, they were behind us, and, we're loud, we're equipped, we carry our sound equipment with us in the parade, and, we have our chance against police brutality. And the MomSad group behind us, they were getting kind of upset, and, they're actually broke out within the ranks of the parade, a kind of debate between us on the problems of police brutality and the problem of violence. They thought, we were ignoring the problem of violence because we were fighting around the issue of police brutality. But I have to say that as a result of that incident, it started an ongoing dialogue between MomSad and POP. And now we're the closest of allies. And MomSad folks have come out to our rallies against police brutality around specific cases, and we go to their anti-violence activities. So it's not as cut and dry as some people might seem to think it is. you know, we're struggling right now trying to get the leadership of other organizations not only to endorse us, because, you know, some people will endorse the march in name, but then it's a whole other question that are you going to mobilize your membership? Are you going to mobilize your constituency to actually participate? So these are some of the challenges that we face.
Well, there is something unique about the Newark locale. Your mayor, Ross Baraka, who has a history of community activism of his own, is the son of the late legendary black activist, poet, intellectual, Amiri Baraka. And Ross Baraka, Mayor Ross Baraka, has pushed the envelope in terms of using his executive power to create a police review board that is in some ways a unique attempt in the country.
Yes, for the first time in the 350-year history of the city of Newark, there will be a police review board. It will probably be actually established sometime, I would say, by the end of the summer, early fall. Mayor Baraka signed an executive order to establish the review board in late April, and it will be the first review board in the history of the city of Newark, and it is unique. It has some aspects. Now, there are a number of cities across the country that have police review boards. Most of them do not have subpoena powers. Some of them do have subpoena powers. And the one established here in Newark will have subpoena powers. But one of the things that makes the Newark Review Board significantly different from the other review boards will be direct representation of community organizations on this review board. It will be an 11-member review board, and I believe 7 of the 11 seats are actually set aside to have representatives of 7 organizations, 7 community groups that have a history of fighting police brutality in the city of Newark. And among those 7 will be included the People's Organization for Progress.
Now, that's an expanded list from the original.
Yes, the original was going to be a 9-member board with, I believe, 5 of the 9 members being from community organizations. But since that time, several other groups petitioned the mayor. He heard their plea, and he expanded the number. He rewrote the executive order to expand the number of seats so he could include some additional organizations. And I agree with that. I say the more the better. And the 2 organizations that have been added also have a history of dealing with police brutality in the city of Newark. So this is one thing that makes, I mean, there are several things that make this board different, but this is one outstanding thing that makes this board different from the others. And very soon, like within the next week or so, the People's Organization for Progress, we're going to start a process to decide who is going to be our representative on that police review board. So it's going to be very interesting. It's a very interesting process, and I have to say, at times, struggle to get through this. Remember, to make a long story short, the Department of Justice came in as a result of a petition from the American Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey to investigate the Newark Police Department. They completed their investigation after several years. They found that the police department did engage in excessive violation of citizens' constitutional rights through Newark's version of the Stop and Frisk program, that they engaged in discriminatory activity in that the majority of people stopped, 85% or more, were African American, that police did engage in the use of excessive force, and that they did even engage in criminal activity, that the gang units, the gang and drug units were, in fact, taking money and drugs from the people that they were arresting, and they were selling it themselves. So, and as a result, the City of Newark and the Justice Department entered into a consent decree, which is a schedule of reforms to turn things around within the Newark Police Department. And a federal judge will appoint a federal monitor over the Newark Police Department for the period that will be identified for the implementation of the reforms in the consent decree. Now, one of the things the Justice Department called for in its report on the Newark Police Department, it called for civilian oversight Now, I didn't specify how that civilian oversight would happen, but the way it's been identified for Newark is the creation of this police review board. So, you know, we're hoping that the experience is going to be positive. I have to say, in truth, that overall, police review boards have not been a panacea for the problem of police brutality. The city of New York is a case in point, which is right across the river from Newark, New Jersey. It has had a police review board for over 50 years. Since 1966, New York City has had a police review board, and it has had a continuous flow of police brutality cases and continuous violation of people's constitutional rights. So we see it is not a panacea, but I think it will, for a city of the size of Newark, I think it will have an ameliorating effect. It's not going to eliminate the problem, but it may bring down the incidence of police brutality and the incidence of the violation of people's constitutional rights. I have to say that even since the Justice Department announced the federal takeover of the Newark Police Department last July, I'm not going to say none have taken place, but usually when we have an incident of police brutality, somehow, some way, the family of the victim will find their way to the People's Organization for Progress. And I have to say that since last July, no family from the city of Newark has come as a result of their son being shot by the Newark police. We do have one family, that's the family of Kashad Ashford. They live in Newark, but Kashad was killed by Lyndhurst police and state troopers in Lyndhurst, New Jersey. I actually think that the announcement, that the investigation itself, the fact that the police knew that the Justice Department was in there investigating them, and the subsequent announcement of the federal takeover may have had an impact, you know, in terms of reducing the number of incidents in Newark. So I think the Civilian Police Review Board will do the same thing, but I'm not under any illusion that it's going to eliminate the problem. I say uncategorically that the greatest antidote for police brutality is the mass movement of the people against police brutality and for police accountability. That is more powerful than any governmental structure that can be put in place.
Yes, this Newark proposed police community oversight board is an experiment in a way, in that you have an activist mayor who is pushing the envelope, and we will see whether the forces outside of the city, the state of New Jersey, will tolerate an institutionally effective and responsive to the community police review board.
Yes, I absolutely agree with that. I think that's where we're going to have more of a problem than in terms of the impact the review board is going to have on the police. One of the key players, key organizations that was active in the whole process of getting the executive order from the mayor and having a process of input into that was the ACLU of New Jersey, whose offices are in Newark, New Jersey. They have historically been in Newark, New Jersey. And we just had the executive director at the ACLU address POP. He said that he expected that before the review board even got off the ground, that the FOP and the other police organizations in the state will try and take the city of Newark to court to get an injunction to stop the implementation of the review board, saying that it violates certain laws of the state of New Jersey and certain other procedures as far as grievance procedures and so on and so forth that the Newark police currently enjoy. So we need to keep our eyes on the situation to see if they can actually stop this thing from getting off the ground. Now, everything has its positives and negatives, and I fully support the police review board. I support the mayor's effort. I support his issuance of the executive order. But there is a problem here with the establishment of the review board by executive order. And that is that the review board established by a mayor serves at the pleasure of the mayor It can be established and disestablished at the pleasure of the mayor, and it can be disestablished by a new mayor. So the question becomes, why wasn't the review board established by city ordinance? In other words, why was there not a municipal law put into effect to establish the police review board? Why didn't the city of Newark pass a municipal ordinance to establish a review board? And although no one has said this, and I have not heard or read anything to the effect, my speculation is that it didn't happen by municipal ordinance because the votes weren't there. Even though we have a black mayor, even though we have a predominantly black city council, five of whose members, I believe, ran on Mayor Ross Baraka's ticket when he got elected, I would speculate that the votes just weren't there. Because if it's established by municipal ordinance, it can't be disestablished by any mayor. I mean, there would literally have to be, the city council itself would have to pass another law to vacate that law. And that's a very, very difficult thing to do.
And on top of that, in New Jersey, as in most states, the cities are the creatures of the states and are subject to the whims of the legislature. This might be a case in which the legislature would exercise its whim.
This is a problem, and this could lead to a much broader discussion on the opportunities and challenges of black power. As you know, black power came out of the black power movement, arose out of the civil rights movement. Civil rights movement got the Civil Rights Act passed and the Voting Rights Act. So now black people have the right to vote. Up came the cry for black power, that is, black people to have political power over the institutions in the black community. And so black people started moving to control these cities where we were majority and to use them as other ethnic groups have used them to try to get a leg up, so to speak, in terms of improving the conditions in our communities. But more than that, a leg up socioeconomically, because that's how other immigrant groups have used municipal governments and municipal political machines, not just to improve the conditions of their group, but in fact as a dispensary of jobs and income for their particular organization. So, you know, the cry was for black power. We elected black people to office. And then as we begin to move to use municipal government in a way to fit the vision of black power that we have, we find that there are, in fact, impediments. There are political impediments, there are legal impediments, and there are structural impediments. Now, in the instance of police brutality, one of the reasons people wanted police review boards because they thought this was a way for the black community to have community control over the police. And one of the important instruments of control over the police is the ability to hire, to fire, and to discipline. Well, I think that almost all, there might be an exception, I'm never going to say none at all, but I think that 99% of the police review boards in the United States don't have that power. And they don't have that power because that power is created by the state legislatures. The state legislatures, which create cities. I mean, if you look at the seal of any city, you'll see on that seal, incorporated in 1868. That means that the city was created 100 years ago. So who did they have to go to get their incorporation? They had to go to the state legislature. So state legislatures have authority, have power over municipal governments. And state law dictates that the power to hire and fire shall rest with the police director, or if they don't have a police director, the police chief, whoever is the designated head of the police department. So for a police review board to have the power to hire, to fire, to discipline, we would have to go to the state legislature to get a law passed to do that. But guess what? These state legislatures are predominantly white, predominantly suburban, and predominantly controlled by interests outside of our community. And beyond that, interests that are antithetical to the interests of our community. So we find ourselves between a rock and a hard place.
But on July 25th, when the Million People's March convenes, kicks off in Newark, New Jersey, you won't have to worry about a hostile city administration in terms of the treatment of the demonstrators.
No, I do not believe so. The mayor has come out publicly. He came to our first major press conference and gave his 100% support to this. We are going to determine what the route is going to be. We've already gotten the requisite permits, and we are determining what the route is going to be. And the role of the police on that day is essentially to ensure the safety of the people that participate in the march. They are not going to be controlling the march. They're not going to be telling us where to go. They're not going to divert us from whatever route we choose, because the mayor has voiced his support for this. And in addition to that, this month we're going to go to the Newark Municipal Council, the Newark City Council, and ask for a resolution of support from the Newark City Council. So, you know, we're trying to make sure that everything goes smoothly on that day. We anticipate a great turnout, and people can help us organize and help us bring people out for the event by going to the Million People's March Against Police Brutality Facebook page. Go to that Facebook page, click join if you're going to the march, and then click invite friends. It's very important to invite your friends, and then also click share. So we want people to join the page. We want people to invite their friends on the page. Like when you click invite friends, you'll get a list of all your friends on Facebook. Then you can click each one of them so that they can get the invitation. And then you can share the invitation with everybody on Facebook. And this will help us get people to the march. It's very important. Go to the Million People's March Against Police Brutality, Racial Injustice and Economic Inequality Facebook page and register there. Let us know you're coming by clicking join, and then invite all your friends and then share it with everybody.
That was Larry Hamm of the People's Organization for Progress in Newark, New Jersey.
President Obama has put the full power of his office behind the super-secret Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, the so-called trade treaty that critics say is really a big business scheme to install a global corporate legal system. According to documents made public by WikiLeaks, TPP includes provisions that would give the giant pharmaceutical companies even more power to control drug and healthcare prices and to decide which medicines are made available to the public. Kevin Zeiss of Popular Resistance explains.
WikiLeaks released a series of documents on the healthcare and the TPP. And they're consistent with documents they released last week on the least talked about agreement, trade and services agreement, which includes health services as well as financial services and education services, postal service, all sorts of things. Basically, what the leak today shows is that our Medicare and Medicaid program are not exempted from the requirements of the TPP. So we expect to see higher drug prices. Pharmaceuticals, are, according to these documents, have now the power to appeal the Medicare Provision Administration to ensure that their drugs are included in the list of drugs available. Generally, they try to include generics in that to keep prices down, but now they're going to be pressured more to include the high-cost pharmaceuticals. And we know from previous leaks that it's not just pharmaceutical drugs that are protected on healthcare, but also surgical procedures and other health doctors' health procedures now will get patented, and you have to pay to use those, as bizarre as that sounds. So it's all about commodifying, and it's all about making money off of people's illness rather than providing a public good. There's, the trade and services leaks, by the way, show that something like a postal service or a health service that might be public, they're going to push it toward private. They don't like the idea of state-controlled or state-supported enterprises, and so they're going to push toward privacy. But once it becomes private, if they move in that direction, they cannot go back toward public. So it's a one-way street toward privatization for any kind of services that we have that are public goods.
So how does this go? This secret document, which would become secret law, would guarantee these corporations price levels, guarantee them, I suppose, market shares and control of industries, and allow them to sue if public entities endangered those price levels or that market share or that corporate privilege.
Well, that's pretty much right. For example, on pharmaceutical pricing, they require the governments, not just U.S., but others around the world that are part of the agreement, to consider things like the cost of marketing as part of setting the agreeing to a price, make it very hard for governments to resist high prices of pharmaceuticals. So, yes, it does kind of rig the market for these big business interests.
From what we have learned of this secret treaty that Obama wants to fast-track through Congress, it would seem to make impossible legislation, for example, like single-payer.
Yes. No, I think it makes almost any public interest legislation very difficult, because what it does is it changes the dynamic. Everything can be challenged in court now. If any new public interest law is put in place that undermines the profits of these corporations, they can sue in a phony court, these trade tribunals. They can sue in order to get their expected profits. And so that makes going into a public interest law very risky, because you are basically risking a lawsuit. And so that's going to discourage single payer. That's going to discourage raising wages, worker safety, environmental protection, banning fracking. So you pick an issue, and it's going to be adversely affected by this. So you really got to take action now. Once they get fast track, it lasts for 6 years. So it's not just President Obama. It could be President Ted Cruz. Could be President Jeb Bush. Could be President Hillary Clinton. So there's lots of bad possibilities in the future if fast track passes.
All of these presidents talk about free trade, but this appears to indicate that the rulers and their political representatives are really only interested in rigged trade.
That's the right language. Free trade is a political term. These are not free trade agreements. These are rigged for big business interests. And that's what's really happening here. And so if you don't like crony capitalism, and I'm speaking loud because I just saw a Republican walk by, I wanted to use his language. But anyway, if you don't like crony capitalism or rigged trade for big business, you really have to vote against this fast track. And that's what we're seeing. And we're seeing on really both sides of the aisle a lot of pressure, a real rebellion from the populace.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.